Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hey, everybody. This is Oney Logan from the Lynch Mob, and you're listening to Talking Metal.
Mark Striegel.
John Astronomy.
The Talking Metal Podcast. Coming to you from the Silver Spacecraft. I'm Bud Friendly, and now your hosts, Mark and John.
Hey, it's John Astronomy coming to you from the Rockin' Pod Expo here in Nashville, Tennessee. We got a really, really special episode coming to you. We got a couple of great guests. We got Noel Monk and we got Oney Logan. But this one's really special because here at the Nashville Rockin' Pod Expo, we got somebody who I've hung out with before, who's been on Talking Metal before, Mr. Joe Becht.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Joe, so glad to hook up with you here in person. The first time that we're meeting in person, and you've done some great reviews for Talking Metal in the review section and some news items on TalkingMetal.com. So please go, guys, and check out Joe's writing on the website. Again, two great guests today. We have Noel Monk, an interview that you, Joe, conducted. He's going to talk some Van Halen with you. Oney Logan, the great Oney Logan from Lynch Mob, is on with us. I had a fun conversation with him about all things Lynch Mob and, of course, Dio Disciples. We're going to get to those interviews shortly. But first, Joe, we are here in Nashville at this great Rock and Pod Expo set up by a bunch of people, but the guy who's really spearheaded it, Chris Sinzak from the Decibel Geek podcast. Now, you know Chris, right? You've been on their show. And
I was on their show once, and I communicate with him via Twitter. And I just really appreciate what these shows do. It's great listening. You guys put a lot of work into it.
Well, thanks.
It helps me personally, and also when I have to travel. And I really enjoy it, so I think this is a great thing that they're doing here.
Awesome. I agree. A lot of KISS fans here today. I feel like the third wheel here because my wife, everyone wants to get their picture taken with her, John signing autographs, and I'm kind of just the guy here with the headphones on behind the desk. But
you're the mastermind.
Thanks. Yeah, the mastermind. I like that. I like that. Anyways, let's talk about KISS. Everyone here seems to love KISS. You love KISS. Although you might not be able to tell so by some of the reviews you wrote on TalkingMetal.com recently. You've seen KISS twice in the last month, I think. Let's talk about that first time you caught them in the last month, which was like, what, your 20-some time seeing them?
Right. It was the July 16th, I believe.
Right.
Yeah, no, it was that
Chicago
weekend.
It was open air.
Chicago Open Air. It was a three-day festival. I went to the first day and the third day. And the first day, I was really excited because it was back-to-back Anthrax, Megadeth, Rob Zombie, and KISS.
Right.
So that's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
I was actually more blown away on the third day by the performances of Stone Sour, Slayer, which was amazing, and Ozzy, who looked just incredible and sounded great, and Zach was just blew me away.
So you were a little underwhelmed by KISS at the Chicago Open Air. Is that true? And was that their performance, or was that their crowd response, or
it was a little bit of both, to be honest. it was interesting. So that was my 25th time seeing Kiss.
Wow.
My first show seeing them was on the Dynasty Tour in 79. I've seen them with and without Yikes. Makeup. I saw them on the Creatures Tour in front of 1,500 people in Dubuque, Iowa. So I've seen them in all capacities.
Right.
They just looked old and tired. And one of the reasons they looked old and tired was one of the biggest surprises of the Chicago Open Air. Rob Zombie was amazing.
Yeah.
He had so much energy. John Five was incredible. They outdid Kiss on the stage show.
Wow.
So I texted, in fact, there's a guy, one of the fellow podcasters here, I texted him the set list. The first thing I texted him was, yes, I said, Kiss is going to have a hard time following this. And I like Rob Zombie. I'm not a huge fan, but wow, they were great. And I wound up, I've been listening to his latest recording nonstop ever
wow.
since.
Cool.
It's just great stuff. And John Five is an incredible performer. You know, it's a no-brainer. You know, we're going to talk about Van Halen a little bit later. It's a no-brainer. You got the dynamic lead singer who has a lot of energy and the kick-ass guitar player. And that's what they had.
Yeah.
You know, they got their theatrics and everything, but it was a great singer. It was Mick and Keith. It was Roth and Van Halen. It was Rob Zombie and John Five that night.
Right. Wow. Very good. And then you saw Kiss, what, like a month later?
Yes. This is interesting. I saw him in Aurora, Illinois.
And that was a better show. That was a better show, right?
It was
right?
a better show. And I know you were originally from New You're around the Chicago area.
Right.
So seeing Kiss in Aurora, how does that feel to you?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But if you think about it, you know,
Aurora, of course, how far from we're talking like an hour from the
Yeah, it's
city
about an
Chicago?
Hour. Yeah. I would say it's about 45 to 50 miles west right. of Chicago.
Yeah.
And, you know, traditionally Rockford, the home of Cheap Trick, was
right.
the second largest city in Illinois. So that was always the secondary market in Illinois. Now Aurora is the second largest city, and you include Naperville in there.
Yeah.
That's a pretty large metropolis. You're talking, yeah. you know, almost a million people in that area. So it made sense for them to play in Aurora. But it still had that Summerfest feel
okay.
at this venue they made in Aurora.
Yeah. Very, very cool. It's funny, I remember the Naperville area. When I lived there in the 80s, that was like the new up-and-coming
right.
area. And from what I understand, it's really developed quite a bit since then.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, on that note, I tell you what, we're going to talk some Van Halen, but first let's talk to Oney Logan about Lynch Mob. This is classic Lynch Mob with Sweet Sister Mercy going way back to 1990. And after that, we'll come back and talk a little bit more.
Yeah!
Hey, that was Sweet Sister Mercy by Lynch Mob featuring Oney Logan. Of course, George Lynch, Anthony Esposito on that. Mick Brown. Wow, classic stuff. Were you a Lynch Mob fan, Joe?
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that first record's so good.
I got a funny story about Don Dokken. Because Lynch Mob, you know, related to Dokken.
Yes,
we went to that Monsters of Rock show with Van Halen and Scorpions and Metallica.
Yeah, I was there.
My cousin had a room at Alpine Valley. And we're hanging out in his room. Don Dokken just walks in and starts hanging with us. So that was kind of wild.
Wow.
And I think shortly after that, the band broke up, and then George formed Lynch Mob.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, cool stuff. And, Joe, I also wanted to thank you on behalf of Talking Metal for your donation to make this possible.
That's all right.
I was talking to Chris Stinzak last night, and he was saying that you made numerous contributions to this Rock and Pod Expo, including one in the name of Talking Metal, so we totally appreciate that.
You don't have to thank me. Thank you.
Yeah.
You guys bring a lot of joy to my life.
Awesome. Cool. And without further ado, this is new Lynch Mob, Main Offender by Lynch Mob, brand new, followed by my interview with Oney Logan, and then we're going to come back and talk some Van Halen.
Mark, how you doing?
Good. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me and Talking Metal.
Absolutely, man. Wonderful to be here.
Cool. Well, let's get right into it. You got a lot going on as usual, but let's start with Lynch Mob. The new album is on the way. It'll probably be out by the time the listeners are hearing this. The Brotherhood. And let's talk
the Brotherhood.
Yeah, I mean I've heard the singles Main Offender and Mr. Jekyll and Hyde, And this is the type of stuff us Lynch Mob fans want to hear. So that's always a good thing. It sounds great. But let's talk about the meaning behind the title, The Brotherhood. Can you fill us in a little bit about why you guys chose to call the album The Brotherhood?
You know, we did a lot of road work together, you know, and doing the miles together, you become pretty tight as a unit, as people, as friends. And looking after each other's back, making sure everybody's up for call, lobby call, you know, getting to point A to point B and all that. Everybody's, you know, well taken care of, you know, come on, let's go get something to eat, that kind of thing. So we decided to, you know, after all that time and miles together to, you know, put a recognition to the type of thing that we were doing for each other. So we called it the Brotherhood. At the end of the day, we thought, you know, this kind of sums it up, you know, for us, you know, at this point. So, you know, everybody in a good mood, everybody's having a fantastic time. We're having good shows and it just felt right. You know, and plus we love those old, you know, 70s albums from the past, from the Allman Brothers, and those guys were like the Brotherhood too.
Right on.
And, you know, we listened to a lot of that stuff on the road and you know, just became a tight unit and a family type of thing, so we decided that would be appropriate.
Absolutely, and you guys have had some strong material over the last few years. You had Rebel, which I was a big fan of that record, Sun Red Sun, another great one. What is different about the Brotherhood? Is there anything you could tell us about maybe the way it was produced or the way it's going to sound that differentiates it from those two records?
Well, I think George had mentioned this before. The Rebel album was done between him and I and our producer, engineer, Chris Collier. We call him the Wizard. And that basically was done between the three of us. It was mostly George and I, and then we had Brian Titchy on drums and Jeff Pilsen on bass, which was wonderful to have them as a rhythm section. They did a fantastic job. You know, so the difference between the Rebel to the Brotherhood, you know, we decided to invite, some main key guys into the band, and we did extensive road work, like I mentioned, and we started working up some ideas on the road. And so it was more of a band effort on this one, opposed to the Rebel album. And I think that, had an effect on the sound and also in the songwriting element in the area of the creativity realm there, as well. And, as far as the recording aspect, it was different too, as well, because we didn't stack it up like blocks and then invite Brian in and, you know, Jeff, as we did before. Everything was finished and we just had them replace the, you know, the electronic drums with the real drums and then, you know, synthetic bass, whatever, for real bass. So this was all cut pretty much live, in a sense. So you'll hear that. There'll be possibly more of a groove type orientated stuff on the, Brotherhood. I don't know. I think also maybe there's a sense of there's a different feel to the sound of the album too as well. There's kind of a colder steel kind of, I don't know, element to it. It gives me the writing was a bit different. You know, I would just take the material home and just work on it and try to find out what it was telling me. And it took a little while for me to catch on that train, but I eventually got it. And, I think all in all, I think it's a cool thing. I mean, we got a little bit adventurous a little bit. There's songs like, The Forgotten Maiden's Pearl, which is, you know, it's got a sort of a Moroccan vibe to it. And the lyrical content is a bit out of the norm that you would find on a typical Lynch Mob or, you know, our type of genre of music. So, you know, I think it's got a little bit of an adventure side to it. It's interesting to me. I don't know. All I can say, it's just kind of fresh. We're always trying to push ourselves a little bit more. Of course, you've got your standard songs that we're known for. We didn't consciously make them that way. We do what we do, and what comes out of George and I is a natural you know, sort of call for us. It's, for me, I describe it as the ancient way of weaving between us, because he just does what he does and I do what I do, and then you have the lynch mob. But, you know, on this out of the Brotherhood, we stretched it a little bit more, trying to be a little bit adventurous, a little bit here and there. And I think as long as we keep on doing that, the interest will be there on his behalf and on my behalf, too, as well, to keep on putting out these albums for our friends and fans out there.
Well, as a fan of what you and George have done together through the years, that's great news. And, I mean, it seems like you guys have been on a roll here these past few years with just great new music. You know, but in the past, there were times in the press that we'd see some feuding between you guys, some issues here and there. What changed with your relationship in these past few years? It seems like, at least from the fan perspective, that it's really strong and better than ever.
I think it was enabling yourself to grow as a person. I think George and I have grown. Obviously, this happens in life. We realize that we have a good thing together. What we do, you know, it's the unspoken language when we get together and make music. And then to finally realize that it's a good thing. It's a positive thing. People like it. Our friends like it. Our fans like it. We still have the outlet from the record companies that would like to put it out. So I think it's just between George and I, it's just humble and grateful for the opportunity that we have to do this together and to make some people happy and take it out on the road. So I think it was all about growth and leaving our egos at the door,
right,
and just get to having fun together and making music, because that's what it's about. It's just making music, and then at the end of the day, you know, whatever the business is that we work out together, it's all been, you know, laid out, fairly and everything, so everybody feels comfortable in what they're putting into the situation, especially between George and I. It's a partnership. So, for him and I, it's something that we can, rely on as a touring entity, and also make records together. So, you know, there's no qualm or any, uncomfortable feelings. We just do what we do now and we try to have a good time.
Absolutely.
Before we turn to dust.
Right. And you mentioned touring. Are there a lot of tour dates scheduled to promote the record?
Yeah, we got a lot of dates coming up. I just saw that we just got some dates posted up, and I will share them here shortly.
Okay.
On my social media pages. But there's a lot going on. We've got some dates with Slaughter. They're talking about a package. I don't know if I'm able to speak freely about this, but there's Slaughter and the Vince Neil package thing that we might be doing. That would be just fly in, fly out dates
right.
On the weekends. That might be happening. There's also dates that might be happening with Queensryche, the new Queensryche. And there's a lot of weekend casino stuff all over the place. And we got some festival stuff happening in the UK. In November, and a few dates in the UK. I think that's about it. But you'll be able to catch us out on the road. We're going down to Florida as well. We're doing 80s in the park. So there's a lot going on.
Awesome. Awesome. Cool. And to switch gears a little bit, we'll come back maybe end up with Lynch talking about Lynch Mob again. But to switch gears a little bit over to Dio Disciples, can you tell me what's currently going on with that? I know you got some European dates scheduled for that, but are we going to be seeing you anytime in the States with Dio Disciples?
At the moment, there's nothing booked in the States. They have, I believe, the first date is November 30th in Europe. I'm not sure. I think it's in Finland. And there's going to be, I think, a string of dates all around Europe at that time, bringing us to the end of middle of December.
Okay.
And so I'll be participating in that. We'll be going out with Tim Ripper Owens as the second guest vocalist. And the exciting thing about it is that we'll be sharing the stage with Ronnie for one song at the end of the show. And I'll let that be a surprise. But it's all a go, and I'll be doing that in December. And as far as any USA dates, touring, I'm not sure what's happening with that, but maybe that'll happen in the, by summer.
Awesome, awesome. And, you know, mm-hmm. Dear Disciples, obviously a band that pays tribute to Ronnie James Dio and the music of Dio. Is there any chance we could ever, out of that project or band, hear new music?
I know that there was talk in the past, and there was some demos going back and forth. I think that's still in the cards, but I can't say for sure if it's, you know, at what time or when it will happen, but eventually I'm sure it will. I know that I participated in one song and Tim participated in another song. So there are some demos flying around, and it just takes the right company to put forth and put the gears behind it. And yeah, so it's basically that's where it's at with the Dio Disciples as far as but I would expect that there would be some kind of album recording to be released.
And would this be new music that was composed by you guys and Craig Goldie, or would it be, is there any music that Dio had left in the vaults that you'd bring to life? What's the writing process behind any new music that we might hear?
Well, I know that Craig has material from the past. I'm sure he has some germs and some riffs that he probably had prepared for Ronnie's next album. Although he has not told me that personally.
Right.
You know, the main creative, you know, germ would be coming from Craig, and then everybody else would put their little, you know, icing on the cake on it. As far as what I participated with on the demo, I had no part in writing of that one song. Who knows? I mean, right now it's basically an idea, to put new music together, and it might happen. I can't promise, but it might just happen.
Right. Okay, good. Well, keep us posted on that, and kind of mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Keep, you know, go down memory lane for a bit. It's been, oh, I guess probably like 27 years now since the just classic record, which I personally think has just aged so well, Wicked Sensation. Did you have fond memories of that record when you look back on it? Was it a fun record to make? Because, you know, sometimes we hear a fun rockin' vibe and then we hear how hard the record was to make. But going back and looking at the production of that record, being in the studio with George and producer Max Norman, Anthony Esposito, Mick Brown, was that a fun record to make? Is it fond memories for you?
I think the initial writing of it was fun. We had rented out this old church in Phoenix, Arizona, and we were just having a blast. You know, we were having the time of our lives. Those guys just came out of you know, the platinum success from Dawkins, and they were, you know, we were rolling. You know, and those guys had just hired me to be the vocalist, and I, you know, I was involved with getting Anthony Esposito involved in the band from New York, and we were just having a good time. And you know, the writing process of that album was fun. We'd do, you know, 4 or 5 hours of writing, and then we'd go to, you know, the Cabana Bar, you know, down the street, and hang out by the pool. We were, you know, real tight. The recording, on the other hand, took a little while because we wanted to do a different type of recording as far as recording the drums live through a PA in the big room at this studio that used to be off of Lancashire Boulevard in Hollywood, in North Hollywood, called One on One, where Metallica did their Black album as well. And that was a cool experience, but the recording, you know, I mean, there's a lot of guitar tracks on that album. The vocals, believe it or not, most of those vocals that ended up in, on the album of Wicked Sensation were demo vocals that were recording on a that I recorded on a SM58,
wow,
which is a live microphone. It's not on an expensive studio microphone.
Right.
And you know, I would have these discussions with Max Norman. I was like, you know, I would just sing all the tracks over again on an expensive mic. But he thought ultimately that the demo vocals that I had recorded on a live microphone, a $125 microphone, he thought that they had more vibe to it and more urgency to them. And I have to say, after all these years, I agree with him because it was fresh. I laid it down on the demo. It was in the moment of creative, being creative and putting it down. I was living in the moment of it, you know, so quite a few of those vocals from Wicked Sensations were demo vocals. We just flew them in, and I was cool with it because it had everything that it needed to put across the energy. I think the process of recording that album with everything that had been done to it and the mixing and everything, it was a labor of love, and it took some time, but we got it done at the end of the day. Everybody did a great job. Max Norman did a killer job on it. And, you know, we kind of knocked it out of the ballpark with that. That seems to be our staple album that people remember us by. It still stands up sonically through any kind of speakers you put it through. And I still get tickled by my friends saying, hey, check this out. You know, they'll
right.
put on while I'm in the car with them, you know. But it was a good time, a great time for us to be together. And George was in a great creative space, and I was excited to be there. It was a great platform for me because I was this young guy, his first album, and George said, "Hey man, just do what you want to do." And so it was a great opportunity for me, and I forever will be grateful to Mick and George for letting me have come up to bat.
Absolutely. Do you hear much from Anthony these days?
Yeah, I just got a text from him. I think it was 2 days ago. He sent me a little video of Jake doing something in the studio.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, they're working out of his studio in Pittsburgh. Pennsylvania. He's
right.
got a ranch out there in Pennsylvania. And so him and Jake were cutting guitars. So they're working on it, you know, and they're taking their time, but they're cutting guitars. So we're still in touch. I haven't seen him in a while, but, he's doing good. He's playing in, the Red Dragon Cartel.
Cool. Excellent. Oni, it's been great talking with you. Thanks so much for sharing some time with us here on Talking Metal.
Thank you, Mark. Take care. And it was my pleasure. It's been real.
Before you hang up, Oni, if you could just give me an ID, if you want, you know, your name from
sure.
Lynch Mob and or Dio Disciples, if you want, and you're listening to Talking Metal, whenever you're ready.
You got it. Okay.
That was I, featuring Oney Logan on vocals. That's an old Black Sabbath classic, originally off the Dehumanizer record, and that's covered there with Oney Logan. It's off the Ronnie James Dio This Is Your Life benefit record. Rowan Roberts and Jimmy Bain also on that song, along with Oney Logan. Great stuff. Thanks to Oney for joining us here on Talking Metal. Now we're going to talk some Van Halen. Joe, you spoke with Noel Monk. Let's talk about who he is.
He was the manager of Van Halen from 1979 to 1985.
Wow.
And he was responsible for the band exploding. Well, let's phrase it. He helped the band financially. They got out of that mess. They had the famous terrible record contract with Warner Brothers. And through his efforts, he was able to make Van Halen get out of that contract and make significant amounts of money and take him to the next level.
Nice.
But the story is one of triumph and definitely tragedy. Yeah. It shows the craziness within probably the most secretive band of all time.
Really? Wow.
And they're a super group.
Yeah.
And he really opens a lot of doors, and it's uncomfortable reading at times.
Okay, cool. And on that note, this is an interview that Joe Back conducted for us here on Talking Metal with Noel Monk. He's got a new book out, obviously, which you're going to talk to him about that, right?
Right.
And we'll have that link through today's show notes. And here we go.
All right, you're listening to Talking Metal. This is Joe Becht. Our guest today is Noel Monk, the author of Running with the Devil, A Backstage Pass to the Wild Times, Loud Rock, and the Down and Dirty Truth Behind the Making of Van Halen. Also, former manager of Van Halen from 78 to 85, correct?
Yes, that's true.
All right, so this is a true story. I finished the book, and immediately after, I went to a sports bar with my son. And the first song we hear is Beat It by Michael Jackson. And can you give us a little insight into that?
Sure.
Okay.
You know, that's when Edward, who was rather foolish, to say the least, and stubborn, was asked by Quincy and Michael to do it. And I said, hey, that's great. Yeah, I love Michael. I said, well, how much are they going to pay you? He says, oh, I don't want any money. I said, well, what do you want, bread? He said, no, I love Michael. I'm going to do it for nothing. I said, Edward, this could be a big record. This could be a big single. Why do you want to do it for nothing? I love Michael. And so we did it for nothing.
Oh, yeah, what a missed opportunity, to say the least.
That you could say that, yeah. Yes.
So, I mean, was there a chance he would get points on the song or the recording? Or?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We could have gotten points on the record.
Wow.
You know, but Edward, by that point, wasn't thinking too clearly.
Yeah.
I never thought too clearly, but at that point it was really bad.
Yeah, wow, what a story. So the book is quite an eye-opener. And for such a huge band, there's so much secrecy around it. And you unveil a lot of what was going on with arguably the biggest band in the world over that time period. And I'd like to go back to the beginning, and this relates to another story. I remember my cousin, who was a few years older than me, coming back from a concert. It was Black Sabbath with Van Halen opening up. And it was this was after the first album, and he said it wasn't even close. Van Halen just blew them off the stage.
Yeah, we had a habit of doing that.
Yeah. So you going back to the beginning, you had an involvement with the Sex Pistols, correct?
I sure did. My best friend was Sid.
Okay.
I was their production tour manager, the same thing I did in 78 for Van Halen. And it was a really great tour. I mean, it was fun. I wrote a book about that, Did you ever read it?
No, and I want to.
It's called 12 Days on the Road, The Sex Pistols and America.
Okay.
And it's very, very accurate. Everything I write is dead on accurate.
Yeah.
But most people write and they weren't there. You know, it kind of frustrates me because I read stuff even in my own, when I Google myself and I find out that I died 8 years ago. so I try and resurrect myself, you know, and I find out a lot of things, you know.
Yeah.
If you were to call up right now or Google, you would still be hearing the in-depth discussion of David's paternity insurance, which
right.
was never in play.
Yeah.
People have a tendency to write, you know, for money and not for brains or for edification.
So I want to get
That's
back.
That's very frustrating.
Yeah, I want to get back to the paternity insurance and the M&Ms and all the folklore. But back, so you know, I think the Sex Pistols, and in my opinion, the Sex Pistols and the Ramones are the only true punk bands. So you said it was a great tour, and I just feel like there would just be craziness. But I'm getting a feeling you go into Van Halen, and it's crazier than the Sex Pistols, right?
No.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking about 10 days
yeah.
as opposed to 7 years.
True.
And you're not factoring in Sid or Johnny or the rest of them. They had a history of closing down shows.
Yeah.
With Van Halen, we never did. We might have closed the hotel down. On a floor, but I never ended a venue.
Right. So you go through the Sex Pistols connection. You're brought on as the tour manager for Van Halen, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, and then from there, you wind up managing the band. And can you go into a little bit about how you came about that and how you? Because there's always the stories out there that Van Halen really got taken to the cleaners in the first couple albums, and you turned that around.
Oh, yeah, you could say that. Their first manager and their lawyer, if there are any folks out there that are starting bands, you got to be wary of your lawyer, your accountant, and your manager, because they will all screw you. Mainly so they can stay in the good graces of the record company. That's not so much true anymore because you don't sell records anymore. The internet pretty well shut down vinyl. And, but still, your lawyer, I mean, our accountant was with us the whole time. And, you know, the first time I met him was at someone's house, and he was just doing lines of coke. But, Michael cost me $100,000 at the end because he made a mistake on my taxes.
Okay.
But, I would recommend watching your accountant.
Okay. So, once again, our guest is Noel Monk, author of Running with the Devil, former manager of Van Halen back in the day, in the heyday of arguably one of the greatest rock bands of all time. So there was a contract, correct? Was it with Olstein at Warner Brothers?
Who was
in charge of
Warner? Oh, Mo Austin. Yeah, well,
yes.
Yeah,
yeah, I'm sorry.
The president of the board, chairman
right.
of the board.
Right. So,
and Mo, you know, when he saw them with Teddy Templeman, he was ready to sign them. And so he made Marshall the manager.
And that's Marshall Burl, correct?
Yeah.
All right.
And, you know, they had a kissy face, lovey affair with the lawyer, and probably cut them the worst deal I'd ever seen. I mean, every two records they got to re-up it, but I had to break that contract. They were making 75 cents on a record, which is way less than a dollar. And what I did was, after the second record, I basically threw stuff at them. You know, like, I needed accounting, I needed money, I needed this. And they did what I wanted to. They forgot about the option. So at that one, made the band probably $50-80 million.
Unbelievable.
But,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then even more so, as you get into the book, you were more than just a manager. I mean, you acted like a family member or a father figure. I mean, there's stories about Eddie's wedding.
Yeah, before and after.
Right.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I wanted you to get a little bit into that. Okay, so let's get into Eddie. I mean, because some of the stuff with him in there, as far as Eddie's wedding, and he comes to you with a very unusual question about sexual relations.
Eddie didn't come to me. I went to him and said, Ed, I just got papers. This nice woman is suing you. A paternity suit, actually the only one we ever got, and so I think you have to take care of it, because you're getting married in 4 or 5 months, and I don't think that would be real good. And he agreed, you know, and I said, you know, well, who is she? And he said, well, she lives down in near San Diego, and I said, well, were you screwing her? She said, oh, yeah. You know, she gave me blowjobs. And I said, yeah, okay, that's good. He said, you know, I love a pretty face in my lap. And I said, yeah, you have it. That's good. So what's the story? He said, well, she only gave me blowjobs. I said, she only gave you blowjobs? He said, well, yeah. You know, that was our relationship. Mostly, you know, in the car. I said, well, yeah, how did you get her pregnant? He says, you can't get a girl pregnant if she gives you a blowjob. And I kind of stopped and thought about that. And I realized that was a slight error on his part. I said, no, Ed. No, you can't do that. It's physiologically impossible. And Ed is a brilliant guitar player. If he had a mind like he played guitar, he would be quite a genius. But that's not the case.
But what you did there is more. I mean, that's it. I used to think that when I was in fifth grade, and your parents set you straight, or, you know, some type of guardian set you straight, and you acted more in a capacity of being a parent there by explaining that. But at such an age, for him to think that was just mind-boggling, which leads to the next thing.
Yeah, well, it definitely is a mind-boggling mind.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot going upstairs going on, but not many light bulbs are lit.
Yeah.
So his thing with me was, he just recently, this is 30 years later, he says, well, Noel was David's puppet. And it's like, God, I wish I could get Edward down to the studio and ask him what he means by that. Because when you read the book, I wasn't exactly anyone's puppet. If anything, he said he spent all his time on David. And in fact, Edward took up more time than anybody. He had more problems and more things to take care of. So I guess, but he's saying these things 30 years later.
Right.
Now he's still harping on Michael Anthony. It's 30 years later, you know. Pick yeah. up something current. You
right.
know?
And you're bringing up a couple of topics I really wanted to touch on. So first is the David Lee Roth. If you were, in fact, a puppet of David, you did not want to manage him when the band fell apart and he went solo, correct?
No, I had had it.
Yeah.
I did not want to manage him. And good, bad, or indifferent, I couldn't have taken any more heading for the nut house.
Yeah. So now, let's the paternity suit. Which it was? How did that come about? I mean, not the suit,
well,
the paternity insurance. I'm sorry.
Do I have yeah. to tell you? I mean, you know how things happen,
right?
Someone screwed this girl. She got pregnant, and I don't know what she was thinking, but she blamed it on Edward.
Right, but then the insurance
couldn't have done it, and. So I said, well, if that's the case, Edward, the smart thing would be to take your DNA test and prove that you didn't, you know, actually have intercourse.
Right.
He looked at me and said, oh, yeah, that's true.
But now with the insurance with David Lee Roth, how did that come about?
Well, you can understand David was very scared of getting a paternity suit. I don't know why, but, you know, basically, he came to me and said, no, this happened to Edward. I've got to get paternity insurance. I said, interesting. And where are we going to get this? He said, no, you can do anything. Just get me the insurance. On $1 million in paternity insurance. He said, okay. So I spent a day on the phone calling up all the different agents, and I got to Lloyd's of London, and they said, no, I don't think we're going to do that. And I could understand their viewpoint, you know.
Right.
David came in. I said, David, I'm really sorry. You're not getting yourself protected. You know, you might have to cap it, but it is not happening. He said, well, what are we going to do? I said, well, you're just going to roll the dice, you know? And so we said, this is a good story. Let's put it out.
Yeah, it was great PR.
So we had Steve Mandel, who was a brilliant publicist, put out that David got paternity insurance. And of course, all the writers picked up on it right away, and it became a big story, because writers don't check things. They could have called Lloyd's of London, found out that you cannot get paternity insurance. But right now, you pick up the phone, you Google David Lee Roth and paternity insurance, and they're still discussing paternity insurance. Which he couldn't have gotten. Now it's only 35 years later. I loved our fans. They're great. But the writers, you know, need something to talk about because we didn't let a whole lot out.
Right.
So that story is still roaming around. I think I cleared it up and cleaned it up in my book. But that doesn't mean that, you know, these writers who were never there, never saw the show, aren't going to resurrect it.
Yeah, and it was great PR, as was the Brown M&M's story. Can you go into that a little?
Yeah, it was pretty simple. Basically, my road manager said, you're not reading the writer. I said, okay, what are we going to do? I know, Steve, why don't you put in that We won't have any brown M&Ms. If we find one, just find $100 of brown M&M. Well, after one of them got fined a chunk of money, it got pretty well spread around real quickly among the promoters, who were sometimes as bright as Ed, that they should check the rider. And they did. And so we had no brown M&Ms, but this became folklore. Why are there no brown M&Ms? Is it a racist thing? Is it something about, one of them can't stomach brown coating? And it's still going on, of course.
Right.
And then we got bored with that, so we said, and also no Coney Island whitefish. And the promoters, what's that? I said, well, you figure it out.
Yeah.
But if you don't have Coney Island whitefish for supper, no one will find you $100. So they're all scrambling, and, anyway.
Yeah. And
you know what Coney Island whitefish
is? I know what Coney Island whitefish is. It's a used condom.
Okay.
And Aerosmith wrote a song about it.
No, but it has to be from Coney Island.
Okay.
And it has to be brought up on shore on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Because I remember hanging out on Coney Island and seeing like a little girl would run up to Daddy and say, Daddy, Daddy, please blow up my balloon.
So,
and all his friends would say, Charles, blow up her balloon. Anyhow, that's the Coney Island whitefish.
All right, our guest here is Noel Monk, author of Running with the Devil, former manager of Van Halen back in its heyday. The next thing I wanted to touch on was the Fair Warning album, which is a favorite of a lot of hardcore fans, myself included. Yet, in the book, you do not have complimentary things to say about it, and it leads to a story about how you needed to boost sales. Can you go into that?
Well, everyone's got their own opinion about a record.
Right.
My opinion's no better than anybody else's. So basically, if you liked it and I didn't, nothing, no story there. But what happened was we had to be a platinum band by that time. And that meant we had to sell a million albums. Well, we had done that with no problem up until this album. And Carl Scott called me. He was vice president in charge of promotion and touring. And he said, no, you got to come in. I said, what's up? He said, you're pretty well stalled at 800,000, and you're not going platinum. I said, no, Carl, we have to go platinum. That's. So I went back to the band, and they were like, what do you mean we're not going platinum? I said, you stalled at 800,000, and you have to go platinum within a year to be a platinum band. And he said, no, you have to do something. And that was always their line. And so I said, I'll do something. I'll buy up all those records. No, almost did. But I went back to Carl. I said, Carl, what are we going to do? He said, I want you to go down to Russ Dyrett, who was head of promotion, and tell him your problem. So I went down to Russ, who I knew, good friend. I said, Russ, we're not going platinum. He said, yeah, you stalled. I said, well, what do we do? He said, I'm going to give you my best guy, and you're going to get on the phone, and you're going to buy up all the stations. And I said, really? He said, yeah. And they were called P1s, P2s, and P3s. A P1 was a major, a P2 was a secondary, and a P3 was a tertiary out in the woods.
Okay.
And a tertiary was $1,000. A P2 was a $2,000, and a P1 was a $5,000. So we spent about $200,000, and the radio started picking it up.
Yeah.
And we went platinum.
Okay. So that was a struggle, and it leads into Diver Down, which Eddie wasn't happy about because of the amount of cover tunes on there. Now,
well, that wasn't my ballywick.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
That's something they had to work out. I had enough stuff, you know.
Sure.
I had their penises to deal with. I couldn't worry about, you know, what tunes were on the album.
But it seems like
important stuff to do.
But it seems like, you know, Fair Warning was Eddie's baby. Very dark, guitar oriented.
Don't say that. He didn't have a baby.
Okay. you needed to push.
Watch it. It'll think that if you say it, you'll have it. You can't have it with a guy.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, but I didn't want you to jinx him.
All right. But so you had to push the sales for Fair Warning, which led them in the direction of creating Diver Down, which had cover tunes and.
No, I didn't have to push them in a direction. They had to make a direction.
Okay. Now, in the Diver Down period comes the US Festival, and you negotiated possibly the greatest deal ever for a band.
Well, it put us in the Guinness Book of Records. It was the biggest deal ever cut.
Right.
I don't know if it still is, but it was $1,550,000.
Wow.
And I had put in. Do you know what our most favored nation clause is?
I do a little bit. If you can explain, I'd really appreciate it.
Well, basically, when Frank Barcelona, Premier Talent, said, no, they're going to come to you. And they're going to come to you and offer you $1.5 million. I said, that's nice. Nice. Nice payday. And I said, but put in a most favored nation deal. He said, oh, that's interesting. It just means that anyone else that they get on the bill cannot be paid more than us. And it actually worked out because Bowie, actually Steve Wozniak called me up and said, Gino, we just signed Bowie. I said, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
He is great. And I knew they had signed him. I knew, you know, what they had signed him for. He said, well, you know, that little thing here, we're going to give them an extra $50,000 so they can bring their equipment over and their clothes and stuff. I said, you know, Steve, that's really nice of you. And, you know, that you're really good guys. I said, but, it would be really fair if we got that extra $50,000. He said, what? You're getting $1.5 million. I know, but Bowie's got $1,550,000, and we've got that clause in there. And he said, yeah, but he said, God, you guys in the music business are pretty tough. I said, no, we just like it to be fair. So we got $1,550,002. And since Bowie was not a band, he was a single act, Bowie got in the Guinness Book of Records as a single act, the most paid, and we got the most paid as a band. And we both got $1,550,000. So my little clause made us $50,000.
All right. So then it comes to the performance. Now, there's different opinions on the US Festival. I personally love it, but it is obviously that Dave is a wreck on there.
What do you mean?
Well, you know.
Come on. That's not fair. He might have been screwed. screwed up and drunk and coked to the gills, but he was basically sober as he always was.
Okay.
No. He was a little specially whacked out of his brain.
Yeah.
The one thing the guys never did was a bad show. But if you pay us enough money, we will screw it up.
Right.
So that was the only bad show they did, because David had trouble walking.
Yeah.
And talking and remembering the songs. Aside from that, no problem. Yeah. And but he also had a problem jumping, you know.
Yeah.
Now he has a problem jumping, but he's in his 60s.
Right.
He can barely, I mean, they're getting ready to do their wheelchair tour, I think. they're going to have a nurse for each guy.
Yeah.
You know, it's embarrassing what they're doing now. They're old men. David can't jump off the drum riser. He'll be in the hospital.
Right.
Back then, he was in incredible shape. He could jump off a building. But nowadays, you know, he's got a little hair left, and he's got this little plaid suit. Kind of reminds me of Johnny Rotten. You know, and he still says the same, you know, little prattle. And
yeah.
And Edward, he's got no hip. He's got half a tongue. I think they actually sauteed his tongue for one night. But in any case, they're old men.
Right.
They should have retired 5 or 10 years ago. They don't need the money. They got millions. But, you know, they like the applause. And people say, well, you're getting the show, but you're not.
Yeah.
These are a bunch of old guys who shouldn't be. I mean, there are some bands that can look good at this age, but David can kick one foot. I think if he kicks the left foot, he's in trouble. but, you know, they're an embarrassment to themselves.
So, back, you mentioned Michael Anthony. He gets crapped on a lot.
I remember Michael. Yeah.
So, in the book, they really take a dump on him. And you hear this repeatedly. You hear it from Sammy Hagar as well. Can you go into what exactly happened? Because it happened right around the 1984 album, correct?
It actually started much, much earlier.
Okay.
See, Michael was a really nice guy.
Yeah.
He never gave me a problem. If you ever see a picture of him, you'll always see him smiling. I think I got a picture in the book with him next to Valerie and Edward. And Edward just looked like his dick fell off. And Michael, you know, having a ball.
Yeah.
You know, and Edward was always like grumpy and angry. And, you know, Al didn't know where he was. But they always picked on Michael because he was the easiest one. And so over the years, he was the one that they would take it out on. It was kind of like the Lost Boys or Lord of the Flies. You know, you pick on the weakest.
Yeah.
And, you know, these guys weren't really nice. So Michael got a lot of shit. And then Al, you know, who doesn't write or doesn't make music, you know, he does with Ed a little bit, decides he wants more money. And the best way to do it is get the guys to dump even harder on Michael. Because Al's a pretty vicious guy.
Yeah.
He's not real pleasant. You know, and he's going after Michael for exactly what they could toss him for. But I think his dick is actually laced to Edward's.
Okay.
So Edward wouldn't let him go. And he knows that. And, you know, so he does whatever he wants. And one night it came to a head in 84. And the record was doing incredibly well. It was obviously a big record. And Al starts on Michael about how he doesn't write music and how he doesn't do lyrics. And I'm thinking, well, Al, you don't either. And then Edward gets on him, and then David walks around the table and had a big plate of food. And he just takes it and smashes it down on Michael's plate. And Michael kind of looked up. You know, he was not a very aggressive guy. And I don't know why he took it, but he did. And then they thought, oh, good. Okay, we can really screw over him now. So they said, listen, you're out of this album. And
yeah.
I'm thinking, but the album's cut. The deal's done. No. We're going to cut him out of the album from before it was cut. I said, the lawyers can do it. I said, I know they can do it, but that's not right.
Yeah.
Well, we need to do it because, you know, he's making too much money. Okay. And nothing I could do because people say, well, why didn't you do something? I represented the whole band, so I couldn't tell Michael, you know,
right.
tell him to screw off. And at that point, the lawyers made up a contract that cut him out, and they all came in my room, and Michael was on the floor with a piece of paper signing it, and they were all kind of snickering off in the corner. So he signed away all his mechanicals and his royalties for that record.
Wow.
Which was already done.
Yeah.
And if he came to me, I would have said, listen, Michael, tear it up, throw it in their face, tell them you're taking the night off. But he never came to me.
So do you think if they called...
they would have lost the show. And they couldn't make him sign it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. No, what was your question?
Well, if he would have called their bluff, do you think it would have worked in his favor?
Absolutely. Yeah. They would have. They, what could they do?
Yeah.
You know, it's before a show. Are they going to lose $100,000 in T-shirts and all that?
Right.
Plus, if Michael stood his ground, they couldn't make him do it. And why he didn't, it's an enigma. I cannot explain Michael's psychology. Maybe you can, Timmy. That would be good.
Well, I'm going to get back to that, but it leads into the 1984 album, which was huge. The band's bigger than ever. Number one single. Goes to number two record in the country. They're arguably the biggest rock band in the world at this point. How the hell did they break up? I mean, what was the relationship between Dave and Ed? And there was like this mystery in 1985. All of a sudden, it just what happens?
There was no mystery. People just didn't know.
Yeah.
I mean, things aren't mysteries. They're just enigmas. They're just things that you don't know.
Right.
And, you know, by the third or fourth year, they were not getting along. Edward and David were not getting along. With all due respect, you could have dumped Al and Michael and replaced them, but you, without Edward and David, there is no Van Halen.
Right. They were like the Mick and Keith, you know, of the United States.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But Al knew that his brother would never let him go. You know, but bottom line was, my feeling was it all hinged on David deciding he's going to do his own thing. And very simple. He just made up his little four-cut EP, and he showed it to me and showed it to Edward, and Edward kind of blanched and said, really? And that's all he said. And the bottom line was he put out this album, which I managed for him. I couldn't not, it was my job. But the problem was if he puts out an album, you cannot put out a show in 85.
Yeah.
So basically, there is no Van Halen anymore. Because you take away 85 when I envisioned in the next 3 years that we could have been playing stadiums around the world.
Right.
We had never gotten to where we should have been. And it's a thing that broke my heart. By 82, I saw us, we had about maybe, I think it's 6 or 7 years, and we would have been a monster band, but we never made it. We were a big band, but we weren't the big band.
Yeah, you know
because, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it did. It broke my heart as a fan. And the subsequent album with Sammy Hagar was good, but the fact is, they should have called it Van Hagar.
Yeah, but you got to understand, David and Edward are Van Halen.
I totally agree.
You know, you can't say that Sharon could ever jump off a drum riser and do a split.
Right.
He would also be in the hospital. I got nothing against Hagar. I never heard much of his stuff.
But it was a totally different band.
If it's Van Hagar.
Yeah.
It's not Van Halen.
And I remember going to see him in concert.
Call it for what it is.
Right. You know, you go and see him. I went to see him on that tour, and it was terrible. They didn't play any Van Halen. It was all Van Hagar. And, yeah.
Yeah, well, so, you know, he at that point had him over a barrel.
Right.
You know. And then they got Sharon, and then the barrel got even bigger.
Yeah. So,
but, I mean, no, it was over in 85. There was nothing left of Van Halen. People say, well, Van Hagar. Yeah, it was Van Hagar. Call it whatever you like, but it wasn't Van Halen.
I agree 100%. Was
not 97?
100.
I'm sorry.
No, 100%.
100%. Okay.
Did David leave, or was he kicked out of the band?
No. He did exactly what I told you.
Okay.
He made it impossible to tour.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted the David Lee Roth show. He thought he was bigger than Van Halen.
Yeah.
And he found out he wasn't. He couldn't sell the 15,000 seaters.
No.
So his band, and they were good. He had Steve Vai. He had some great musicians.
Right, he had Billy Sheehan on bass.
Sheehan was brilliant.
So that first tour and album did well, but then after that it kind of fell off the cliff.
Yeah, but it did well because it still had the hangover of being Van Halen.
Right.
I mean, you could have replaced all four of them and brought in a bar band and called it Van Halen, and you would have sold out the Forum.
Right.
you know, it was a name at that point.
So what?
It's like if you want buttermilk, you can call it anything, but they still want their buttermilk.
So I'm always fascinated by the business aspect of music, which I'm kind of in the dark about, but do you have any? So when David left, did Van Halen with Hagar become a new corporation called Van Halen? Was it a new?
I have no idea.
Okay. All right.
I was gone. I don't talk about what happened afterwards because I wasn't there.
Yeah. Okay.
I wish people who weren't there, who never saw the show or didn't hang with the band, they should shut up.
Yeah.
They weren't there. They don't know what went on.
Right.
You asked me a question about Van Hagar. I don't know. I wasn't there. Why should I say anything?
Okay.
I'm as ignorant as you are.
Fair
Probably
enough.
More so.
Fair enough. We're with
I think I'm dumber than you.
No, stop. All right. So we're with Noel Monk, author of Running with the Devil. We're going to have to wrap this up shortly. I wanted to just go over, if you could say a few words about each member of the band. We'll start with that. You talked a little bit about Eddie, but so let's go back to Eddie. What can you say about him?
I can say that Edward is probably one of the most brilliant guitar players of his generation or any generation. I don't compare him to anyone. People say, well, is it Hendrix or Edward?
No, he was...
They're two different guitar players. Yeah. I don't want to hear which one's better. They're both brilliant in their own right.
No, he was a game changer in Baltimore.
Ed is also probably one of the dumbest people I ever met. So you take a brilliant guitar player, mix him in with someone who is completely dumb, and you got Edward.
All right. Now let's move on.
The guy who thought he got someone pregnant by giving him a blowjob. You know, that Edward, you know, was pretty well run by Al. Let's get to Al. Al
All right,
was
so
drunk.
Let's move on to Alex then. I was going to go David next, but let's go to Alex.
Yeah, okay. I was going to go to Al.
Okay.
You know, he got to understand, after all those years of having a younger brother who was everyone fawned over him, and rightfully so. He was brilliant. You know, and Alex was a good drummer, but there were a lot of good drummers. So he was always ninth or tenth after Edward, or 20th. His younger brother was important. He wasn't, and he knew it.
Yeah.
And so he got mean, and he started really drinking in 82.
Okay.
And, I mean, there's a story in my book where he came into my room and woke Jan and I up and drank the whole mini bar.
Yeah.
Two scotches, two vodkas, two whatever. I would have thrown up immediately. And Al said, "Hey, Jan, let's go party."
Yeah.
Well, okay. Then we got Michael, who is one of your wonderful people. Good bass player, relatively. If you speak to Edward, 30 years later, and he's still got a hard-on for Michael, and I don't know why.
He does, yeah. He
can
goes...
talk about anybody else. It's 30 years. And he's still talking about, you know, Michael.
Yeah.
He's saying, "I'm David's puppet." The guy really isn't there.
All right.
You know, there's not much upstairs. So you have Michael, who is a great guy and got a voice like an angel.
Yeah.
But has this thing where he cannot stand up for himself. It's like he's got everything but legs.
Interesting. And then let's finally
And then you got David.
Yeah.
And, you know, if there isn't a mirror in the room, David won't go in. You know, he's got to be able to look at himself. You know, pucker his lips. And, you know, do that. And you don't know from moment to moment which David you're going to get.
Yeah.
You know, the one that's a total jerk or the one who's the nicest guy in the world. And it's very scary because, you know, if you came to work every day and your boss would, you wouldn't know whether he was going to beat you with a whip or give you big hugs and take you out to lunch. And it was that bad.
No,
this guy had it was scary with that guy.
Yeah.
You know, I don't scare, but, you know, and when David was mean, there was no one I've seen that's meaner. Well, maybe Al. Al was pretty mean. Not too bright either, but he was very greedy.
Okay.
David wasn't that greedy. He came from, his dad had made a lot of money.
Yeah.
And he was the only smart one in the bunch. David was very smart.
Okay.
And he was very quick. And he was sharp as a tack. And he didn't have to be a brilliant singer. He was a rock and roll singer, and that's what he was.
Yeah.
And he did it very well. I don't want to hear he wasn't, you know, an opera singer.
Well, neither was Mick Jagger.
He was a rock singer.
Right. Mick Jagger isn't either, you know. Yeah.
No, Mick's maybe a better singer, but David fit perfectly. And he was an athlete. The guy could have been in the Olympics.
Yeah.
He worked that hard. You know, I've never seen anyone work an hour. I mean, you got football players who always have hamstring problems. What David did, he never had a hamstring problem because he would work out an hour, of course, in front of a bunch of mirrors, in the dressing room.
Yeah.
And loosen up. And never pulled a muscle. He was bright. Very, very bright. But totally impossible to read.
So,
there's them. And then there's this interviewer. You're a good guy. I'm just kidding you. I enjoyed this interview. And,
no.
And you've been a lot of fun and you put up with me, which is, you know, not that easy.
Well, I can't thank you enough for joining us.
You're a fun guy.
Yeah. So once again, thank you. It's Noel Monk, and his book is Running with the Devil, A Backstage Pass to the Wild Times, Loud Rock, and the Down and Dirty Truth Behind the Making of Van Halen. And it is down and dirty. Noel, I can't thank you enough for joining us.
Ah, it was my pleasure. Are you kidding?
So
I didn't think you'd invite me.
Oh, come on now.
You did.
Yeah. So all the listeners out there, go to the Talking Metal page, go to Mark's Amazon link and click it on, buy the book, correct? That's the best way?
Absolutely. Yeah. Don't buy the book, buy the books.
All right, buy the
books. For everyone in your house.
All right.
All your friends, anyone you ever met. And that would be actually better than buying the book. But if you buy the book, that's okay too.
Well, Noel, thank you again. Have a great evening.
I'm glad.
Right.
I had a good time. I enjoy interviews. And you've been a pleasure to work with. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hear About It Later by Van Halen off the Fair Warning record. We are live at the Nashville Rockin' Pod Expo here in Nashville, Tennessee, obviously. Joe Becht has been my co-host on this episode, and thank you for doing that interview.
Oh, it was great fun, and man, that guy can talk. It was easy interview. I just wanted to ask some basic questions and let him run with it.
Nice. And I'm trying to think what else is going on. What's the next review you're going to write for Talking Metal? Anything coming up?
I haven't worked on that yet. Maybe I'll review the podcast convention in my experience down here.
There you go.
Yeah.
I
know you have experience in film. I think that it would make a great documentary about podcasting.
Yeah, I think
it would be riveting.
Yes.
If you would do something like that. But back to the Noel Monk interview. I'm glad you chose the song off of Fair Warning, because that plays a really interesting part in the album, how the sales stalled and they were worried.
Right.
And, you know, there's always talk that was Eddie's album. It took a dark corner, and David wasn't happy with the dark tone of it. But a lot of the hardcore fans, that's like their most metal album.
Yeah, I love that.
And Noel, according to Noel, he had to do the payola thing significantly to make it sure it went platinum.
Wow.
Because if they didn't go platinum, they would tank. And then that subsequently led to The Diver Down, which had a lot of covers. And then
I'm trying to think. I want to say five covers on Diver Down. Is that right?
Yeah, and Eddie wasn't happy
cover,
with
What was that?
They did Hang 'Em High. Dancing in the Streets.
Right, Dancing.
Pretty Woman.
Was Hang 'Em High a cover?
Hang 'Em High was... No, not Hang 'Em High. I'm sorry.
The
Kinks song. Hang 'Em High was an original.
Right.
Where Have All the Good Times Gone?
Right. Where Have All the Good Times Gone? Right. Pretty Woman, Dancing in the Streets. Big Bad Bill. Right.
Happy Trails.
Yeah, Happy Trails. That's five. It's five,
and Pretty Woman?
Yeah, we said Pretty Woman. Okay. Yeah, so I think five sounds correct, but have to check that to be sure. Anyways, great talking with you, Joe.
All right, Mark, so you mentioned Chicago Open Air, and I just wanted to play a song from the album of the year. It keeps on getting better every time I listen to it, and it's the new Stone Sour album, which is called Hydrograd. And that's a big story right there. It's a pretty interesting story how Corey named the album. Song I really like on there. I mean, I love all the songs, but I'd like you to play Red, Rose Red, Violet Blue. I just think it's an amazing song. And anybody out there, get the new Stone Sour.
Absolutely. Here we go. To take us out, a little Stone Sour.
My life in stocks in order. They're on the rise this quarter. Beware of certain friends who sell you out when everything is free. I know what I am to all of you.
Stay home and ask yourself, why am I so low when I'm so high? Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.